Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Welcome to our show. Today we're joined by Mr. Ben Gay III. He is considered one of the nation's top professional salesmen, sales trainers, and professional speakers. He has addressed nearly 300,000 people all over the world. In 1976, he pioneered the 800 number telecommunication industry, which today creates billions of dollars of revenue. Mr. Gay was dubbed the attitude coach to the astronauts and ground crew of Apollo 15, 16, and 17, and he has edited and or authored many books, including my favorite sales book of all time, Closers Part 2. Ben, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that.
I was reading Chapter 1 this morning, and you say your life changed when you answered a business opportunity ad and talked with a gentleman named Bill Dempsey.
Correct.
How old were you, and what were you doing at the time?
I was 22. I was working for my father in the food brokerage business. I was trying to put my first wife, Marcia, who's passed away, through nursing school, and discovered I just didn't have enough money to make that happen. And we were living in what today is one of the fanciest apartment buildings in Atlanta, but then it was a little long in the tooth past its prime, so it was not exactly what I had promised her. So I began, in fact, it was one day only in my life and one ad only. It said, anything if you know anything about marketing plans and want to make more money, dial this number. A little classified ad, probably under sales help wanted or business opportunities or something, and I dialed the number, and my life changed.
The proposition Bill Dempsey made you on that day required you to come up with $5,000.
Correct.
In 1965.
Right.
That was an unbelievable amount of money.
Well, it was an unbelievable amount of money for me. It was almost exactly, by coincidence, $5,000 more than I had.
That means it's a lot of money.
Yeah, I didn't have the money to get out of his parking lot when I left. I literally ran the gate after my opening interview. I came around the corner. I didn't know it was. I'd never been in that building, 1447 West Peachtree Street. I can picture it like it was yesterday. Came around the corner, underground parking, and there's the bar hanging down. And the guy in the booth, you know, and with his hand out, unless you had been to the Trust Company of Georgia and gotten your ticket validated, he expected you to stop and give him, I don't know, $2-3 or whatever it was. And again, an absolute coincidence, whatever it was $2-3 more than I had. So I looked to the right. He raised the bar for it hadn't come down yet from the car in front of me. But he was to my left. I looked to my right like I hadn't seen him, and drove right past his outstretched hand up over a little hump and into West Peachtree Street. And it was like Steve McQueen in Bullet. When I hit, one of my hubcaps came off, but I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to stop to get it. So I just drove on in my Nash Rambler.
What picture did Bill paint of your future that got you so excited?
He made me, first of all, I didn't know what my dad was making. My dad was a successful food broker and well-regarded in the industry, and we belonged to, you know, we, through my family, belonged to Eastlake Country Club, one of the finest country clubs in the world, and so on. I just never heard figures, but I knew what I was making, which was next to nothing, and Dempsey started talking about he was making $10,000 a month. And I'd seen his new Lincoln downstairs in the reserve spot with Dempsey on the license plate. So I said, I don't believe you. And he says, well, let me show you. And he starts pulling out checks. And over the past roughly year, he had averaged over $10,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the way I looked at it was that solved all my problems. My wife could go to nursing school. We could get out of our high-rise hovel. I could get a car with four hubcaps on it and get back. The kindest thing, my mom and dad were wonderful people, but the kindest thing they ever did, I don't think they even did deliberately. they set my comfort zone high.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in a nice neighborhood. We had nice cars. My dad had many employees, good friends. His friends, you know, were the chairman of the board of Coca-Cola, Bobby Jones, the golfer, et cetera. And then when I left home, and I could go down the street two blocks to the club and play golf or tennis or what have you, and hobnob with people that, looking back, I probably should have gotten their autographs. I just thought they were folks, you know. And when I left home, that stopped. I mean, stopped zero. He wasn't mad at me. He just said, you know, you said it's time to fly. Well, let's see you fly.
Mm-hmm.
So all that went away. And in our little apartment at 75 Ponsilian Avenue in Atlanta was furnished with my half of the bachelor furniture that Jimmy Rucker, my running buddy, and I, my first business partner, had together, which included those cement blocks. Do you remember those? And you run boards between them.
Yes.
That became the cooking surface. The apartment had no kitchen in it, so Marcia and or I washed dishes in the bathtub. It was a two-room apartment, not counting the bathroom. So if someone was in the bathroom, the way you went from the living area to the bedroom was you raised the window, stepped out on this beautiful balcony, went to the other window, raised it, and stepped into the bedroom. And if you plugged in more than, I think it was two of our appliances, you know, an electric fry pan and a toaster or whatever, but if you plugged in any two, you were fine. But if you plugged in three, you blew out all the fuses on the 11th floor. So we weren't real popular with our neighbors either, because I couldn't quite seem to get that rhythm down. So it was an interesting beginning. But that was the reason I was looking in the paper. I was, you know, a high school graduate. I spent 3 weeks in college. I was elected president of my freshman class and dropped out before they could swear me in. And I was only elected president because of my name, Ben Gay, sort of hard to forget. I came in second in the senior class. So the write-in
you could have gone right through to the senior class, no problem.
Yeah, I could have got, if I'd known that, I'd stayed with them and graduated. But that comfort zone, I remember walking in after a day of calling on grocery stores, going up the old antique elevator, and walking into the apartment and looking around and thinking, this is odd. I mean, this just, you know, isn't the way I was raised. Enough personal stories, but I'll tell you one quick one that was cute. We asked Mother and Dad to join us for dinner one night. It was probably at a hamburger stand or somewhere, but, you know, come down, see our apartment, we'll go out to dinner. And Dad drank bourbon and soda, so I went out and got a little half pint of bourbon, whatever I could afford of some brand he probably wouldn't think of drinking normally. And had some ice and soda there. And he came in. Dad was sort of a clothes horse. He looked just like Jimmy Cagney when they were the same ages.
Mm-hmm.
He came in, took the drink, took one tiny sip, and put it down, never picked it up again. So I assume it didn't meet his standards. And wouldn't sit down. And he never said it, but it was obvious he didn't want that material from my half of the sofa and my half of this to touch his suit.
Oh, man.
And we were in and out. I mean, you know, from the time they arrived to the time we were going out to dinner was like 5 minutes. And I thought, this is humiliating. Never again. And the next morning I got the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and started looking through the want ads.
So Bill paints this picture of potential wealth, and then he does something unusual. He basically says to you, I don't think this business opportunity is for you, and pretty much prepares to leave. How did you react to that?
Well, he did a takeaway on me, and he also had something I didn't put in the book anywhere, I don't think. He had a rejection stamp. It just said reject on his desk. And he told me later, it was a big rubber stamp.
Yeah.
He told me later that the original stamp he had thrown out because people couldn't read, you know, the mirror image when you're looking at a stamp.
Yes.
So he had it redone in mirror image. So when you looked at it from your side of the desk, it said reject. And, of course, if you stamped it on a piece of paper, it wouldn't have been any good. But nevertheless, that wasn't what it was for. It was for you, the prospect, to study. And every time you started to say anything negative, he would sort of slide his hand towards the rubber stamp, and you'd change your tune. But finally, after some period of time, it didn't take him long, I'm sure, to figure out I had no money. I was in my Robert Hall suit. I don't know if your listeners remember Robert Hall, but that was where you got two pants, a reversible vest, a sport coat, and a hat for $49. So I didn't exactly look fantastic. He must have figured out I wasn't a high-profile prospect, but he later told me, you give everybody a shot. So he said, I wasn't really throwing you out of the office, but I figured you're going to have to rise to the bait. So he said, I'm wasting my time. I don't think you can get the money, but you've got 24 hours, or I think it was, to be standing back here in front of my desk and have all the money in the form of a cashier's check.
Now, that would mean that you had a pretty interesting week ahead of you.
Yeah, I did. Or never come back was, I think, one of the things. Or I never want to see you again, some semi, you know, in case you missed the original message. So down the elevator I went, ran the gate, got out of the parking lot, and began to think, well, I can print lots of stuff. I print, well, the notes I send you are printed.
Yes.
But the only thing I can sign is my name, my signature, Ben F. Gay III, and Jimmy Rucker's name, which is James H. Rucker Jr. I can sign those in cursive. Everything else looks like a chimpanzee wrote it. So I went over to where Rucker was working that day, took his 1957 Chevrolet, and sold it. A two-door, four-on-the-floor, big engine thing, and sold it for $2,500. Called another friend of mine who I worked with at Macy's before and said, Cliff, I'm going to give you a great opportunity, $2,500 and you're in. You get a third of the business. And he quickly made arrangements with somebody to put a little $2,500 lien on his house. Then I had to go pick up Rucker. Rucker came out and he said, hey, how you doing? I said, I'm doing fine. He said, what, are we doing something tonight? And I said, no, I just thought I'd take you home. And he said, well, I was going to take my own car. And I said, well, Jim, we need to talk. We're in the cosmetic business now. And he said, well, that doesn't change the fact I'll drive my own car. And I said, well, it sort of does. That's how we got in the cosmetic business.
Now, the name of this company was called Holiday Magic.
Holiday Magic, yes. One of the first multi-level companies, network marketing now they call it. And in its day, bigger than Amway and Shackley combined were at the time, in other words.
Would it be fair to say you rub shoulders on a daily basis with possibly the greatest sales team ever assembled?
I think that's perfectly fair. J. Douglas Edwards worked. You know, if I tried to keep all the timelines straight, we'd spend the whole time just talking about that. So let me just say that rather quickly I started succeeding in the business. I became president of the company. In the meantime, I was working with these folks on a day-to-day basis. Zig Ziglar joined the company the same day I did, September 15, 1965. He was a young cookware salesman from Columbia, South Carolina. He's now 81, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Edwards, who used to sound like God when he was talking to you from the platform, first great modern-day sales trainer, if you discount Elmer Wheeler and Red Motley. But Doug sort of turned it into an industry. Earl Nightingale, the Nightingale Kona Corporation, worked for us. Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, worked for me the last 2 years of his life. Fred Herman, the great Keep It Simple salesman trainer who appeared on the Carson Show in a legendary appearance, lived right down the road in Cedartown, Georgia. This company, you could make so much money if you worked hard, and it was taking in so much money, we just sort of, it was like a magnet. You know, remember the magnet you dragged through the sand when you were a kid, mm-hmm. all the black things attached to it?
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of what happened. All these people joined. I didn't have anything to do with them joining. They were all young adults or grown adults. I was 22, still had acne, a flat top, and weighed 142 pounds. In my cheap suit, and so I was just, I mean, you talk about blind luck. People say, well, you know, but you worked hard and you became a good salesman and so on. True, but blind luck. I've often thought, Bruce, if I had my life to live over again and I hadn't seen that ad, I really wonder where I'd be today.
That's interesting. Life changed because of an ad. And you weren't even in the habit of looking at ads.
First and only time I've ever looked at a want ad with me in mind. I've scanned them, you know, seeing what the competition was doing or what have you. But with me in mind, I've looked at want ads one time in my life. It was so depressing, I never, that was one of the reasons I didn't go back, because I'm not qualified to do anything.
In the closers, you have a quote. It says, there's no graduation day for a true professional salesperson.
Correct.
You were around hundreds of them in one organization. What do you mean by that, that there wasn't a graduation day?
Well, I mean that you just always are learning. You know, there's all sorts of cliches. If you're not growing, you're rotting and so on. But you're always learning. Today on the phone, I was doing a teleconference with one of my clients in the home improvement industry. You've heard me talk about him, Hugh Harris with Dixie Homecraft.
Yes.
And one of his salespeople has just, one of his office managers, but slash salespeople, in Knoxville, Tennessee, his name is Joe Stinger, has just had an incredible month. They have 10 big offices, and his office in Knoxville did about 40% of everything the company did this month.
Mm-hmm.
And the company had a good month. And Joe said, they were talking about how they're working out of the closers. They use their foundation of their sales training program is my material, the closers. And Joe said, Hugh said to him, Joe, tell us how you're getting such mileage. What's happening here? And Joe says, well, I finally got the word, and I've got them dug into the closers now and so on. And he said, one thing I do is I walk around behind every person and pick up their book while the meeting's going on, or they're watching a DVD or something, and I thumb through it. I'm looking for underlines, highlight, the backing cracked frequently. You know, they've never been in the book.
Yes.
And I'm looking to see if they're working it. And I thought, that's good. And I made a note. And at the end, when we were sort of wrapping up, I said, guys, I hope you all caught that. I've been at this 42 years this year in big commission income. I've been selling since I was 14, but 42 years of pretty solid stuff. I've been teaching and working and adding to the closer series for 30 some odd years, 31 years I think it is this year or something, and it's never dawned on me. I mean, they're funny stories. I've walked in people's offices, gone to pick up the book, saw it's never been opened, tossed it back down. But it's never dawned on me what a quick way that is to take their temperature. Look in their book.
Mm-hmm.
And he discovered that everyone whose book was marked up heavily, they were in like that. I'm making up numbers now, but let's say there were 10 salespeople in the room. The books who were marked up heavily, that was his top five salespeople.
You know, it's funny you say that. This morning, you know, I was looking through the closers. I noticed that my book was more marked up. The closers too is more marked up than any book I've ever had.
Well, thank you.
I must have really paid attention, and there really is so much. So many good things in that book, and I'm just not saying that. You know that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that book, and that's actually prompted my phone call years ago when I called you. I was so enthralled with the last chapter of that book.
Sales Infiltration.
The Sales Infiltrator. When I read that chapter, I was blown away. I thought, I have got to call this man.
Well, I remember the call very well, and it was the start of a wonderful friendship. I was really impressed that, you know, the closers part one is the red meat of selling, the kicks, the blocks, the punches, and everybody loves that. And frankly, it outsells the closers part two. One, because it's number one, and then two, because it's got, you know, the stuff people want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But Sales Infiltrate, the closers part two is a better book, and all sophisticated salespeople know that. They probably ought to read one first so they know what we're talking about. And then Sales Infiltration, starting on page 257, is, in my humble opinion, the finest thing ever written about selling, even though I wrote it.
I completely agree. Here's a quote I love, because you're going to try and explain it in a second. Here's the danger of trying to explain it. It's going to sound so simple that the odds are you'll discount it, thinking, I already knew that. Trust me, you didn't.
Yep.
I love that line.
Well, and now you know it's true, right?
It is true. It takes sales to a level that you almost can't call it sales, because it doesn't seem like it's happening.
One of the guys on the phone this morning in Atlanta said, it's almost mystical, Mr. Harris. It's mystical. Yeah, if you first read it, because I read it in sort of an inspired state. I won't say the pen was moving by itself, but I wrote it in longhand. And as soon as I knew I was on to something, I got up and locked the office door, took the phone off the hook, and just went at it nonstop. That's the what's in the book is the first and only draft of that. and exactly the way it was written. And a few of my friends read and said, yeah, that's nice. And I thought, wow, maybe it wasn't as great as I thought. So I went back and read it again. So then I went back to them and said, what do you mean that's nice? And I said, well, you know, you ought to build friendships and be nice to people and follow up and so on. I said, no. Please forgive my writing skill. Maybe it's lacking somewhere. Read it again. And that's the reason I now tell people when they get that particular book, read the last chapter first. It ought to be the first chapter in the first book instead of the last chapter in the second book, but I wasn't that smart 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I said, read that 4 or 5 times before you start through the rest of the material, because what it gives you is, you know, when we were young, they'd give us puzzles to put together, and on the cover of the puzzle box was a color picture of what the puzzle was supposed to look like when you got done. That was a huge help.
Yes.
You know, if you don't know you're building a battleship, it sort of makes it a little more difficult to put the puzzle together. The sales infiltration is the color picture on the puzzle box of a successful sales career.
One of the things I read this morning, it said the normal sales setup is it's your job to sell, their job to resist. How does being a sales infiltrator change that?
Well, you don't. That is true. And most people look at that like battle lines, but you have to look back to the definition of infiltration. And we talk about passing through, crossing over, becoming one with the other. The way I sell and the way sales infiltrators sell and the way I know you sell is we don't have a them and us philosophy. We don't have a good guy, bad guy, white hat, black hat philosophy. We spend time getting on their team and making it our team, and by our, I mean theirs and ours.
Mm-hmm.
One team who acknowledges a problem and collectively, together, in unison, looks for the solution. So there's no one of the toughest things I have to do, I was telling the group this morning, is when I do a seminar, people want to know, how do you overcome this objection or that objection? Well, in the closer's part one, right at the back of the book, there's a thing that I think it's the 15 most common objections and 45 ways to overcome them. It starts on page 2, whatever it is, and you know goes on for 6 or 8 pages. I always read that before I do a seminar to refresh my mind of how you overcome objections, because as a sales infiltrator, I don't hear many objections, hardly ever. In fact, what it always, almost always is the money.
Yes.
That's what it always is,
mm-hmm.
is the money. But we've developed a relationship where I don't have to dig them out. You know, they smoke out their problems. I don't smoke anybody's problems out. They tell me, we got a cash problem here.
You know, it's funny. I probably own everything that I know that you've written. And I don't think you've ever sold me a thing. I never feels that way. I want whatever it is you have. And
yeah,
I
don't spend a lot of time selling.
No, you really don't. No, you're very good at what that last chapter is. You actually are that concept. And every time I get in a sales position, I think of being a sales infiltrator and how that takes the pressure off, because I am now thinking on behalf of the client. Completely. That takes a lot of guts, actually. It is a salesperson to turn over almost the greed process and say, I'm willing to do whatever is in your best interest. But ultimately, boy, does that get you some loyal customers.
Well, I popularized the phrase fair enough. I mean, I don't claim to have created it. It's probably been around hundreds of years. But in selling, I now hear it everywhere I go. And I first wrote it in a book or a newsletter or something maybe 12 years ago. And part of it was that I was raised as a polite Southern gentleman. If you tell me to get out of your house, my inclination is to get out of your house. You know, I wouldn't make a good Kirby vacuum cleaner salesman. You'd never have to call the police on me to get me out of your house. So I try and avoid that. So I listen. I turn it over to them. I make sure they understand we're on the same team. I also make sure, I call it the SOL clothes, the standard of living clothes, that nothing they do is going to affect how well I eat or dress or live or anything else. So they don't have to, you know, feel bad about it or wonder if I'm making too much money or what have you. That's all off the table or on the table,
mm-hmm.
therefore off the table. And then when you get down near the end, I say, well, based on what you told me, here's what I recommend, but you do whatever you want. Fair enough.
Ben, I can't believe, honestly, we're out of time. Ben, thanks so much for joining us, and look forward to getting to speak with you.
Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
Check out www.thenorrisgroup.com for upcoming live speaking engagements and education opportunities in May and June, including the Norris Group's REO Bootcamp. Visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or call 951-780-5856 today for more information. 951-780-5856.